Hey folks, I'm Jim Ambusky, and this is Conversations at the Washington Library. So I just got back from a conference in Edinburgh, Scotland, and while I was in town, I do the things I normally do when I'm there. I climb Arthur's Seat, eat haggis, pop down to the pub for a wee dram, and hey, thanks to Norman, by the way, for introducing me to Lechick. And I decided to meet up with an old colleague of mine, Rachel Hosker. Rachel's the Deputy Head of Special Collections and the Archives Manager at the University of Edinburgh Library. She works in a library that was founded in 1582, and for the past couple of years, she and I have been working as part of a team on a transatlantic legal history project, and maybe we'll talk about that in a future podcast. Now, on one of my last trips to Edinburgh, Rachel had arranged for my colleagues and I to see a George Washington letter in the library's collection. And since I was back in Edinburgh, and this time I was in George Washington's employ, I thought, well, why don't we talk about this letter on air? So in today's episode, Rachel and I talk about a letter that connects Washington to Adam Ferguson, one of the central figures of the Scottish Enlightenment. And Rachel also brought out a Washington book in the library's collection as well, and this volume, which is entitled Washington's Political Legacies, was published in the months just after his death. We'll post links to both the letter and the book on our webpage. And you'll also hear how Rachel's interest in archives began at a very early age, and how she knew almost immediately that she wanted to work with rare materials and manuscripts. And for your researchers out there, you'll get a taste of the library's amazing collections, including the Lane Collection, which holds this Washington letter. Enjoy!
One of the things I wanted to ask is, do you ever get tired of the view out here?
No, well, only when you can't see it, when the rain comes in and the clouds, but then that's like being in a weather station. You can look and it's almost 360 view and see what's coming in terms of the weather. But it is nice being able to offer that for researchers as well, that kind of environment where I've worked in archives where you're in the basement and there's no light, and that to have that ability to have a nice environment to work in is great.
Well, I think the first time I came up here, I was just amazed that, you know, you could see Arthur's Seat out the back window. But then, so what is the area that's sort of, I guess that would be
there's
the south?
It's the Pentland Hills, and you're looking towards the Scottish borders, which is a mainly agricultural area of Scotland. And it was the area where when Scotland was an independent nation, there were a lot of sort of cross-border raiding that went on. So it was a bit of an area of no man's land, but it's very beautiful down there as well.
Well, it's very green this time of year too. I mean, it's always green, but particularly here in the summertime.
So
your official title is Deputy Head of the Center for Research Collections, is that correct?
It's Deputy Head of Special Collections,
Special Collections
and Archives Manager for the University.
So what is it that you do here?
Good question. No. I deputise for the Head of Special Collections, and our Special Collections cover archives, rare books, manuscripts, photographic collections, film collections, medal collections, you know. So it's those unique items that are part of the university's knowledge base, but also part of the university's heritage collections, part of the university's corporate memory. So we've got that base of what did the university do and how we got to where we are at the moment as well.
And how old is the university itself?
1583. But we always say that the library came first, because in 1582 Clement Little gifted his library to the proposed Towns College. And so that was something that was there in place before teaching started in earnest in 1583.
Wow. Gosh, that's amazing. And so how many items are in the entirety of the collection? A whole bunch, would be fair to say.
It depends on how you calculate that, because we don't look at just books or individual items, because you'd be entering the millions.
Right.
So thousands. You'd be entering the thousands, upon thousands. But we also, at the Centre for Research Collections, have a converged service. So we have musical instruments, we have art collections, and we've got the digital side of things as well. So we're one of the only places in the UK that offer that rounded view of cultural heritage collections at an institution like this. And that's for the benefit of our researchers, so that, you know, they can look at an artwork, at the correspondence of the artist, that they can look at a book about that in one single place rather than having to go to several.
So you try to be, in a sense, a one-stop shop and present a holistic research opportunity in some ways.
Rather than a one-stop shop, I would say it's a place where the collections inform each other. And the professional knowledge and skills of the staff inform each other. So I've been an archivist looking at a letter from the artist Ben Nicholson, who was married to Barbara Hepworth, another famous British artist, saying, "Well, Barbara says she's sending you her sketch from the Venice Biennale that she'd shown at that event that year." And across the table, my colleague, who was the art collections curator, was looking at that actual sketch of Barbara Hepworth.
Wow.
So these things have narratives and relationships between them that we don't tease apart in an unnatural way.
And how long has the library pursued this kind of strategy? Because it seems like, you know, that would have to be a conscious choice to, and part of your acquisition process. And
so it's been a gradual development. I remember I worked back here on a project in 2000, and yes, there was a special collections department here. The more recent establishment of the Centre for Research Collections was in the mid-2000s. Okay. There was that conscious... When the library was refurbished at the university, that was a conscious decision to have a dedicated centre that included not only special collections, but the museums, musical instruments and art collections offering as well.
Wow. So at what point in your life did you decide to become an archivist? Or how did...
I'm really sad.
Yeah.
Okay. So, it's that moment when you're 14 and you get sent to the careers fair at your school. And there's various people you can talk to. And I went and spoke... My mum worked in libraries. So we went to say hello to her boss that was there. And... He was asking, "So what are you interested in?" And I said, "Oh, I love English. I love English literature. I love history. I really love history. I love art." And he said, "Well, would you be interested in going and spending a day with our archivist, which is just the local authority archivist, in half term when you're not at school?" And I was like, "Yeah, that would be great." So I went along at 14 to see Dave, the archivist, in the local area. And I remember he being a busy man, he left me with a box, the black legal boxes of 19th century correspondence. I had no skills in paleography at the time, but had a whale of a time trying to decipher and sort this box out. Did my best. It probably wasn't very good because no training. But loved doing that. And then in the afternoon, he took me out to Camelot Shipyard, a shipbuilding company that's based on the Wirral, where I grew up. And we were working with a volunteer to look at where there were shipbuilding plans, where there were records of this company.
But this is in Liverpool,
this,
is that right?
This is, well, it's opposite Liverpool on the Wirral. And I got to sort of, it was in a you know, you're hunting out records, and it was in a working store, so it's a bit grimy and stuff, but we were finding these amazing plans, and that just clicked, and I just thought, I love doing this, and talking to the people I was working with, what they were trying to do about making this stuff accessible, and so from there on in, just got experience in various means and ways in libraries and archives, and went on to do the master's course after my degree.
Wow.
14, I know.
That's really, but it's great at an early age, you know, that you kind of knew exactly what you wanted to do. Most people, I don't think, necessarily
just,
do that.
It did just click. And I did investigate looking at other things, like, should I go into teaching? I thought, maybe I don't have the patience. or should I go into, you know, look at other heritage occupations? But this always just... drawn back to archives.
And how long have you been here at the university?
So I've been here since 2012.
Okay.
Worked on various collections, from College of Art collections, which I mentioned earlier, to the wider collections, things like medieval manuscripts, business records mm-hmm. as well.
So in your role here, you help organize a lot of exhibitions or help or at least help facilitate exhibitions abroad by loaning out materials?
We can, not just myself, across the team, we have loaned material out to institutions where the conditions that we expect mm-hmm. are met. And we do, that part of the reason for that is we do have unbelievably brilliant world-class collections. Mm. And sometimes sometimes little-known collections that have that big impact once they're out there.
What's a good example of one of those collections?
The Lane collection, for example, that was a collection that was the item that we're going to talk mm-hmm. about is from, and he was a 19th century, he worked with his father in the book trade, but he went on to become quite a polymath. He was a librarian to the Signet Library. He was a historian, a writer. But for us, he was a collector. Mm. So we have described as a bit of a glorified skip jumper, because he would hoover up things that were being disposed of sometimes in the 19th century mm-hmm. where people were selling things off, there were sales of things, to amass this massive collection. He also was sent items by people. Because of his knowledge, he was known. He knew lots and lots of people. He was known as this brain, I would say, that people could inquire about Scottish history, but it was wider than that. And it's quite a difficult collection to communicate, because it's so vast in its reach, both geographically mm-hmm. But chronologically as well, and in subject matter. So it showed his interests were just broad. So there are real strengths in things. There are items that were from the French Revolution. There are letters from Hans Christian. There's a note from Hans Christian Andersen. There are items from kings and queens. There's material from, obviously, Robert Burns and mm-hmm. Sir Walter Scott. There are household accounts. There are things on theatres in Edinburgh. There are church records. There's a copy of John Knox's History of the Reformation, wow. which we think would have been done by scribes contemporary to him, and potentially even he might have had sight of it, and whether any of the annotations are him or not, we don't know.
That's amazing.
There's music in there, there's humour in there, there's fire and brimstone sermons in there. So the whole of life. So it is a difficult, so Lady Grange's kidnapping documents about that, which is a Jacobite affair.
What did he buy?
I know. So when people, we try and describe this collection as a jewel in the crown of the university's mm-hmm. collections, it's really hard to communicate because of the breadth of it.
And he had a George Washington letter.
Yes, which we have out.
Which we have out right before us.
Some of the items he had, he will have acquired. We don't know how we acquired mm-hmm. some of them, but there's potentially he acquired them through his connections at the university, and there are University of both Edinburgh and Glasgow people in this collection. And this one particular letter is to Dr. Ferguson, that's Adam Ferguson, mm-hmm. who was one of our professors here. And Adam Ferguson was part of the Carlisle campaign, the peace campaign in 1778, and received this letter from George Washington in that capacity.
And let's see, I think it's dated June the 9th, 1778.
Yeah.
Looks like it's in the hand, at least the text is in the hand of Washington's aide-de-camp, Richard Hanson Harrison, but of course there's the GW signature right there.
It's clearly absolutely.
So what is this? So Adam Ferguson, you know, major figure of the Scottish Enlightenment.
Yeah.
You know, hugely influential in shaping knowledge about civil society and things of that nature. But he's part of this peace commission, right, to essentially try to convince the colonies to come back into the fold.
Yeah.
2 years after independence. And what's going on in this letter?
So at the time, I think the British forces were retreating. And so he's writing to ask for passage. Ferguson wrote to ask for passage and permission to go and try and convince people. And what it says, the letter which accompanies this will inform Sir Henry Clinton that I cannot grant the passport requested by his favour of the state without the previous instructions of Congress. Mm. That really struck me, and we displayed this letter a couple of years ago for a display for the National Archives Awareness Campaign that was looking at rights and politics and democracy, because essentially that one sentence is saying, I'm doing this through a democratic process. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was quite powerful.
And he's clearly subordinating himself to Congress.
Yeah. Yeah. It doesn't say much else on this occasion. It's this, I have thought proper to advise you of to prevent you the inconvenience of proceeding should this find you on the way.
What's interesting, you know, as you rightly say, it's, you know, Washington is viewing this through the lens of a kind of democratic process. You know, he is the commander-in-chief of the Continental Army, but, you know, he takes orders ultimately from the civilian. They want to treat with, you know, the opposite field commander as opposed to giving legitimacy to this Congress that's declared itself independent of Great Britain.
Yeah. And it's interesting that we have a University of Edinburgh individual, mm-hmm. a key figure of the Enlightenment involved in this.
So what's the significance of that, do you think? And what does it mean for the university, too?
Yeah, it's an interesting one, I think, because you, not being, you know, academic expert on these things, but it makes me think of the Enlightenment and the way people mm-hmm. were thought in that process as being the intellectual, the rigor behind that, but thinkers and philosophers. He dealt with philosophy. Mm-hmm. So they wanted someone who had that breadth of being able to communicate and think and persuade, and being of an enlightenment mind may be able to mm-hmm. do that.
And hopefully to appeal to enlightened minds on this or on the other side of the Atlantic as well.
Absolutely.
I forgot where I was for a second. on this side of the Atlantic. Wait a second. No, I'm in Scotland at the moment.
And he mentions General Sir Henry Clinton. Mm-hmm. So it's Ferguson's acting as an intermediary. Mm-hmm. So it's not being general to general on this particular. It's this bit in the middle.
Yeah, it's a weird situation with, you know, in 1778, you know, it's not necessarily a stalemate, but you know, at that point, neither army has the upper hand. Clinton and British forces have a little bit more momentum, and certainly by the next year when they reconquer Georgia and then take Charleston in 1780, they've got a lot of momentum. But, you know, what's really fascinating, I think, is that, and I don't think, you know, a whole lot of folks who read about the Revolution realize that, you know, there was a moment where the British tried to negotiate some kind of settlement, two years after independence, but then
ultimately failed,
and
There is the fact that while you've got Ferguson doing this, there were people trying to bribe congressmen at the same time. So that it's not quite as flat a landscape. There's many kind of machinations and things going on.
Multifaceted campaign to bring people back into the order.
Yeah.
But, you know, by this point, having stuck their neck out and declared independence, would have been very difficult for them to go back, at least, you know, yeah. members of Congress and whatnot.
I think we've spoken before. Yeah, it's the point of no return, isn't it? It's, mm-hmm. we're here now.
We're really by, you know, of course, July 1776. Once the Declaration comes out,
that's it.
You know, there's no going back. Either you win the war, or you're going to be hung by the neck until you're dead for treason.
Yeah.
And they knew that.
Yeah. What also strikes me is the language of the letter. It's, you know, it's not get lost, it's not angry, it's very polite. That there was
right.
the language of diplomacy mm-hmm. is being seen here. You know, it's saying, we can't grant you this. This is the process we go through. I'm trying to get this to you to save you the inconvenience mm-hmm. Of trying, basically.
Right.
But it's very strong and clear that that's it.
Right.
No, it's a definite no.
Thank you for coming, but...
But no.
but no. Yeah.
Yes.
Well, and I think you're absolutely right. It's you know, clearly two 18th century gentlemen who are among their respective elite, you know, treating with one another.
Yeah.
And, you know, and of course, always the closing line, your most humble, you know, what does he say in this one?
Your
most
I have the honor to be, sir, your most obedient servant, George Washington.
And sometimes I think it's easy to look at that as basically their form of sincerely, comma, you know, signature.
Yeah.
But and that really was indicative of the fact that they saw themselves as you say, treating with each other in a diplomatic manner and a kind of acknowledgement of their respective statuses.
Yeah, that's an interesting point there as well, Jim, because the response is giving a status to this mm-hmm. response by the language that's used as well. It's not just a dashed off note. It's constructed carefully,
mm-hmm.
and so whatever the language that was used in the first place, they're reflecting back, you know, that language
right.
that shows the status of diplomacy. Therefore, they have legitimate status as Congress, as a government.
Right, exactly. And I should say now that you've digitized this letter. It is available
yeah.
online, and so we can...
It is, and we have it on a CCBY license, which means you can download it and make use of it with acknowledgement mm-hmm. of where it's from. And we have that as a policy for things that we can do that within copyright legislation, so that, you know, as custodians, we're making the knowledge that's here at the University of Edinburgh mm-hmm. in the City of Enlightenment available to the world.
It's a very enlightened position.
Hopefully, yes.
And, you know, we'll certainly post a link to this on the webpage for the podcast. And, you know, even though it has been transcribed and it's a part of the Papers of George Washington Project, you know, at University of Virginia, and appears, I can't remember which volume it appears in, but it's always a lot more fun to see the real thing.
Absolutely.
And I think when I was here last year and you all had said, oh, you have a Washington letter. We're like, what? You know, what is it doing here?
How did it get here?
Yeah. And so we, Mr. Lane obviously just went about collecting everything. So but we don't quite know how he received this specific letter.
Not this specific one, but where he operated was very close to the university. And he knew many, many people at the university. His house was down in Portobello. It's not there any longer, but apparently when he passed away, it was creaking at the seams in terms
oh,
of stuff. But it doesn't surprise me that he has this letter.
Mm-hmm.
Just the path of how it got into his hands. As with many of the things, you know, we know for some of them that they were bought at sale,
mm-hmm.
but others of them, it's not quite so clear.
Maybe, and I can't remember if there's anything. I guess I should ask, may I touch the letter?
Of course, yeah.
Yeah, anything?
It's just...
Uh-huh. And it's been indexed here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Very cool.
But there's a little squiggle at the bottom. I'm not quite sure. So it's some of the marks on it, yeah. I think this is just indexed
right.
correspondence.
Would have been probably done either contemporaneously or like, yeah.
Yeah.
Very neat. So you also have brought out very kindly for us a book.
Yeah. So I was thinking, what else do we have? We have a number of items, published works that were contemporary or just after Washington passed away. So this is a first edition of Washington's political legacies, which was published in New York in 1800, and is one of the volumes that came into the university library probably fairly early on. Mm-hmm. So in terms of the collecting of the university library, it's always been pretty on the ball in terms of contemporary, in terms of contemporary literature, but also histories and that. We also have the part of Adam Smith's library. So you get see an Enlightenment library right there. The other part is at the University of Tokyo. The two parts went through different
directions
for, in the family.
Oh,
so
I
different
see.
Branches of the family got aspects of it, but that's fully catalogued and people come and request items out. And it's a fabulous collection. So while
that's
Adam Smith
amazing.
Was doing that, this was being published and it was
well, what's amazing about this book is, I mean, yeah, as you rightly say, it's published 1800, so a year after Washington dies.
Yeah.
But it's published in New York.
Yeah.
And, you know, late 18th, early 19th century, there are not a whole lot of American presses cranking out books at that point.
But okay. I think this is fairly widely available. Hmm. I mean, it is a unique item in many respects, but there are copies of this in quite a few libraries in the States and here in the
in
UK.
Here.
But it has that oversight. So we were talking about what the letter actually means, and then we've got the book on his legacy. And so we're kind of exploring some of that with talking about the letter. But it's a biographical sketch, life and character, his will. This came in the 19th century here. Early 19th century, so...
Okay.
Yeah, it's in pretty good condition as well.
Oh, and it's got, and I've actually never seen this book before, but it's got in the contents, his commission from Congress to command the American Army, orders on the cessation of hostilities, circular letter to the governors of the several states at the close of the Revolutionary War, addressed to Congress, acknowledging his imminent service.
It's quite a large...
So really, this is... It's got a biographical sketch, but really it's a compilation of some of his writings.
What I found most interesting as well, at the very, very back, are the lists of subscribers.
Oh, the subscribers. That's always a fun thing to find.
Yeah, who will have made this happen. So could, you know, go through the list and identify, American subscribers who... were names at the time or had impact on American history following Washington.
That's really cool. I love seeing the subscribers' names in a lot of the books. That, you know, the first edition of Blackstone's Commentaries on the Laws of England in 1772, there's a similar list. You can see, like, every major lawyer who's worth his salt in that period's buying that book. And so, you know, would be a really fun project to dig through this list of people and just see, you know, who's purchasing. I'm just trying to see very quickly if I recognize anybody. That's quite a substantial list.
Yeah.
I mean, and in a lot of ways, not unsurprising, given, you know, it comes out almost immediately after. So in a lot of ways, this might actually function as one of the earliest compilations of GW's writings. And
mm-hmm. Yeah. It does have, you know, it has a biography, but it does have
that's in great
transcriptions of letters and various other things. So letters like to the gentleman of the House of Representatives, you know, when he passed away, things that John Adams had sent. So it's quite nice. It's not just, for example, Washington's writings, but in terms of legacy, it's the people around him and what they were saying as well.
Well, and getting back to the earlier conversation about the letter, and you spoke about that being indicative or emblematic of a democratic process, and just looking through the table of contents and the kinds of of material that's contained within kind of speaks to that same notion, I think.
Yeah.
You know, the deference to Congress, you know, that, you know, getting a commission from Congress is, you know, you're commissioned by the representatives of the people. And, you know, of course, very famously, Washington gives up power at the very end of the war, you know, shocks people, and then does it again at the end of his presidency. There's this apocryphal story where George III hears this, and he says, you know, if Washington has voluntarily given up power, he's surely the greatest man who's ever lived. It's not really clear if the king said that, but, you know, it makes for a good story. But it's but it kind of fitting with this idea of, as you say, you know, a democratic process. But also, you know, the title is, you know, very striking, Political Legacies. It's almost as if this is a...
it's still the consolidation of it, isn't it? Mm-hmm. It's quite a statement as a book.
And who's there's a someone has inscribed their name there. Do we know who that?
Yeah, I was looking at this the other day, and I think it's a William, but the ink has bled so much that it's very difficult to actually decipher. But it potentially is a William. And then we would have to do some more work on that, I would say, because it's so.
It looks like it's, the ink bled.
Yeah, YME at the end. So we can work on that.
Well, that's the next research project, figuring out who that is.
That's part of the fun of it, deciphering handwriting.
I mean, sometimes you want to bang your head against the wall, but then you get that wonderful moment when you figure it out.
It's like a magic eye puzzle. You stare at
it. Oh, I could never do those things.
Stare at it and go, no, I'm not getting it. And then suddenly it unravels before your eyes. Mm-hmm. So,
I'm just looking at the... that's the original binding, too, it appears. So.
Yes, it is. I did a bit of checking online and to see if I could find any other images of original books, original bindings that were out there. And yes, that's the original binding as well.
And I know you have some other things in your annex. I guess it's an off-storage site.
We have a couple of other contemporary volumes to this on Washington's life.
So the John Marshall biography, right?
Yeah.
Right. Well, I mean, that's really cool because that, you know, that's the first major biography. And we've got some back in Mount Vernon, the first edition. But, you know, here, this is almost kind of like the progenitor, or the, I guess, the great 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 grandfather of the modern editorial editions of the papers projects, but it's really cool.
Yeah, it's the sort of analog form of bringing all those things together.
So, how would this have been acquired by the university? Would it probably have been a gift or purchased at a sale or?
So. Many of the items that came into the university from the 16th century onwards, there was a practice of when students left and they did well in their careers, they would send a book back to the university as a gift.
Oh.
So some of our collection is student built.
That's neat.
And it still is today. The students have input into how we build collections. Some of them were purchased. So, you know, other forms of gift can be through the academic community or where people are studying particular things or have an interest and then pass that on to... we would be able to... I haven't done so, but we would be able to look at the reference number to give us an indication of where that would fit chronologically, but also if we can... it would take some time because of the way the records are structured, but you could see if it does feature at all in our accessions books that we have for the 19th century.
Wow. And how is there a great deal of material here for people who are interested in studying the American Revolution or, you know, the late years of Britain's North American Empire?
There are pockets of material, like you've seen the letter and that, and there is more correspondence in the Lane collection. I would say that there's probably a bigger amount of material for the governance of Florida and earlier than that. So we have material on the period from the sort of 17th century through the 18th century and some of the difficulties surrounding that. area.
And do you have any, so you have records from James Grant of Ballendock, or speaking of East Florida?
Probably.
Because I know, I believe his...
Let me just check.
Yeah. Wand at the ready.
Yeah.
Certainly, because he's, I believe the original papers are still at the Ballendock Castle, but he was a frequent and prolific writer when he was governor of East Florida, and so...
So we have bundles of the connected with the family of Johnston of Westerhall, Governor Johnston of Florida.
West Florida.
So we're talking 1716, but then there's a question mark about it being 1767, actually. But
that would make more sense.
Yes. Yeah. I think they got the date wrong originally in the printed version, and it's been corrected. And then the second...
Well, that's pretty interesting.
The second one is a paper of 48 folio pages, orders and instructions to George Johnston Esquire, governor of West Florida, with the signature of King George III, 1763, and also two papers of oaths administered to officers of the colony.
So these are the commissions, the governor and the colony's administrators,
right
when they take possession of that from the Spanish.
Yes.
Wow. That's cool.
I mean, how Lane got these, I don't know. You know,
West Florida was kind of a disaster. I mean, that was like the one assignment you didn't want.
Yeah, and there's more. There's letters to George Johnston about naval dispatches when he was Commodore in the 1780s. So
wow.
Later family papers as well. So.
And, you know, that's great to know because there are some good histories of East and West Florida, but, you know, really when we talk about, you know, the period we call the Imperial Crisis or the post-Seven Years' War period, Florida kind of gets left out, unfortunately, but there is just a lot of dynamic things happening down there. You know.
They're probably quite an interesting example of, where I've said before, we have world-class, amazing collections, and how many people will know that we have these?
Right.
So
well, now they will.
Now they will, and they can come and use them. Yeah.
And they can use the reading room and look out on Arthur's Seat and the borders.
And ask for these items out of the Lane collection, section 2, and it's around 76 and 70, around 73 and 76.
Wow.
So they could just order them out and then work their way through them.
Well, I know from experience it's a very pleasant place to do research. So.
Yeah. I know it can be daunting going to an archive and doing, you know, a strange archive and then you do the research. And some researchers are very used to that, but if you're new to it, it can be quite daunting. But it's a very friendly team here.
It is.
Make you very welcome.
I absolutely agree. Well, do you have any big exciting events coming up that you can reveal to the world now, or?
Well, we do a number of exciting projects that are funded by the Wellcome Trust, and one of those we have next Thursday an opening exhibition on movement and physical education in Scotland from 1890 to 1990, and in particular focus on women. So going from the 18th century, we've been talking about right the way through into the 20th century and looking at movement and aesthetic and health and welfare. So that's exciting. We're looking forward to opening that. And we've had things, that's the breadth of our collection, which you can go from one century to another, from one format to another, and we'll be having digital versions of our films that we have for that of it as well.
Wow.
Can't get film from the 18th century, unfortunately.
Yeah, we haven't really gotten that time machine thing figured out yet, but one of these days. Well, if anyone is in Edinburgh in the near future, you've got a fine exhibition to come to and then pop on up and maybe see a George Washington letter as well.
Absolutely.
Well, Rachel, thank you very much.
No problem.
Thanks for listening to Conversations, a production of the Fred W. Smith National Library for the Study of George Washington. This episode was produced and engineered by me, Jim Ambusky. Our theme music is entitled Mount Vernon, was composed and performed by Ginger and David Hillebrand. And if you'd like to support this podcast, as well as new research into George Washington and his world, please consider becoming a Mount Vernon member. More information is on the webpage for this podcast. Hasty back!